I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, historian Neil Ferguson. But first, with the president of Afghanistan by his side, President Bush this morning, responding to senators' demands from both parties, promised that as soon as possible he would declassify a national intelligence estimate that reportedly concludes that the war in Iraq has fueled the global jihad movement. The president also said he disagreed with the report's findings. We'll continue following that story. But meanwhile, President Bush told President Karzai that the U.S. would continue to stand behind Afghanistan.
I know there's some in your country who wonder not whether or not America has got the will to do the hard work necessary to help you succeed. Mm-hmm. We have got that will.
Wonderful.
And we're proud of you as a partner.
In Afghanistan today, a suicide bomber killed 18 people in the south of the country where NATO troops are fighting a fierce Taliban insurgency. A bombing outside of the capital, Kabul, killed an Italian soldier and a child. And Afghans are mourning the chief of the Women's Affairs Office in Kandahar province, who yesterday was gunned down outside her home. Well, joining us on the phone from Kabul, Carlotta Gall, who covers Afghanistan for The New York Times. And Carlotta, welcome back as always. And President Bush mentioned this assassination in his news conference today. You write this was the highest-level assassination of a woman in Afghanistan since the Taliban was overthrown 5 years ago. Tell us more about this woman who, you write, opened at least six schools for other women.
Yes, she was a well-known figure down in Kandahar, her home province, and she'd worked for years as an educator, both as a teacher and a high school principal, and for the last 5 years as head of the Women's Affairs Department, which is the local provincial chapter of the Women's Ministry. And so she'd done everything for women, basically, increasing education, opening schools, expanding vocational training. And then she started working in women's rights, helping, solve domestic disputes and helping in adjudicating for women on a lot of issues that come up. So she'd done a terrific amount of work with local women's groups, particularly. So was well regarded in this town.
Well, we understand also that Sophia Amajan had some enemies because she favored, according to some sources that we spoke to in Afghanistan, she favored some tribal peoples over others. Is it clear that she was killed by the Taliban, or could this have been another act of violence?
To my mind, there's no doubt that it's a Taliban attack. She was a soft target. It was the classic sort of thing they tend to do. She didn't have any enemies through her work. She was from a Shiite minority, but everyone down here says that she really wouldn't have had any enemies, whether relatives or class. I think it's a classic Taliban attack on, as we've seen many times before, on educated people or influential people. They killed the head of the clerics council in Kandahar. They killed teachers in villages and outside their schools. So it's to me, it has all the hallmarks of Taliban.
How shocking is it that a woman wearing a burqa, wearing traditional Islamic dress, would be killed?
Well, I think what's more shocking is that women are very highly regarded here. It seems strange in Western minds, but they're shrouded in veils and they're kept at home and so on. But to the tribes here, that's great respect and protection for women. And so to kill a woman in the street, and she was shot four times in the street outside her home as she was walking out to the main road, is very shocking, because sort of public slaying like that of a woman is the ultimate in disrespect. Mm. So extremely shocking, I think.
And Carlotta, we just have a few seconds, but we understand that President Karzai is to have dinner with President Bush and Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf tomorrow night. Karzai has criticized Musharraf for not doing enough to close Pakistani religious schools. Musharraf has criticized Karzai for not doing enough to stop the terrorists there. It doesn't sound, and again, we only have a few seconds, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be a good meal.
I think it's going to be very tricky, and the crucial thing will whose side President Bush takes, or how much pressure he puts on them both to stop the squabbles.
Carlotta Gall reports from Afghanistan for The New York Times. Carlotta, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in his huge new book, The War of the World, historian Neil Ferguson documents what he calls history's bloodiest century, the 20th, 100 years of slaughter sparked by, he says, empires in decline, ethnic disintegration, and economic volatility. He believes these factors come together in an overwhelming deluge of human hatred during an age of unparalleled human progress. He also cautions that these forces are at play today and may shape the history that will eventually be written of the 21st century. Neil Ferguson is professor of history at Harvard, and we wanted to spend some time with him today. He's also a research fellow at Oxford College, and he joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Neil Ferguson, welcome.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And first, let's go to your overarching thought, because I can see minds ticking and thinking, oh, really? You know, well, what about? So you say the 20th century, most violent century in history. What about when the Mongols reigned, you know, Genghis Khan?
It's pretty hard to work out these figures for the ancient times. So one has to be cautious here. And remember, World War II looks like one of the biggest man-made calamities of all, with a death toll of around 60 million. There's very few events in human history that can compete. Some earlier events may have led to very high death tolls through indirect means. For example, you have a war and it leads to a famine because agricultural systems are very fragile. Mm. But the key point about the 20th century is that most of this violence is intentional, man-made violence, directly and willfully caused. And that means we have something very, very hard to explain. The existence, as I try to argue, of hatred in the midst of progress.
I just want to give some of the numbers that you give. You say by one estimate there were 16 conflicts throughout the 20th century that cost more than a million lives, a further six that claimed between 500,000 and a million, 14 that killed between 250 and 500,000. In all, between 167 million and 188 million people died in the 20th century?
Yes, one really scary statistic is that one in every 22 deaths was a violent death. But of course, some places are way more dangerous than others in the 20th century, and some decades are much more dangerous too. So what I found was very helpful was to ask the question, why was it so dangerous to be born in, say, Ukraine or Poland or Serbia in around 1904? And it was relatively safe to be born, as I was, in Glasgow, in Scotland in 1964.
Well, you came to some conclusions, including that there were three common threads that you believe run through this violent century. And I'm flipping through this huge book now, and I have to say, it's very depressing. Pictures of pogroms in Odessa in 1905, the bodies of dead Armenian children. Here's Greeks fleeing Turkish troops in 1922. There's Hutu, Tutsi, Nazis, Pol Pot, Mao. Tell us a little bit about these three common threads that you find running through all of this violence.
For me, the key things that link together nearly all of these episodes of extreme million-plus violence are, firstly, and this is in some ways the most prosaic of the three, economic volatility. It's when economic life is very bumpy, up and down, very violent swings in activity, that societies seem more likely to descend into conflict. And the most economically volatile time in the 20th century was the interwar period, the 1920s and 1930s, not least because of the Great Depression. But two other things are really critical here. One is ethnic disintegration, by which I mean the breakup and descent into violence of multi-ethnic societies. One of the most striking findings of the book is that the places where conflict was most likely to occur were places like that triangle of territory between the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, and the Balkans, where an enormous proportion of the violent death of the 20th century occurred, particularly in that time between around 1904 and 1953, which encapsulated and included the two world wars. And finally, there's the phenomenon of empires in decline. And I argue that it's when empires disintegrate that violence tends to spike, because it's at that point that contests break out at the local level for future power.
Remind us of some of the empires that declined.
It starts off with the Qing dynasty, the Chinese Empire, descending into chaos, republic followed by civil war. Then, of course, there's a great crisis of empire in the First World War, which leaves four empires on the floor in various states of disintegration: the Ottoman Empire, the what became modern Turkey, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Romanov-Russian Empire, and the Hohenzollern-Prussian Empire in Germany. And the story then continues with another great crisis of empire in the early 1940s in Asia, when Japan launches a hugely successful war against the Western empires in Asia, the British, French, Dutch, and of course the American Empire in the Philippines. So the story of imperial crisis continues through World War II. After 1945, we have what historians call the era of decolonization, when the West European empires very slowly and painfully broke apart. And finally, towards the end of the century, of course, you have the disintegration of the last great European empire in Eurasia, which was, of course, the Soviet Union. Mm. And at each stage in this process, there are really very substantial spikes in violence. A good example of this is what happens at the end of British rule in India, when partition leads to enormous outbreak of violence that claimed a million plus lives, as far as one can establish, as Hindus and Muslims fought against one another. It's a classic example of what I was describing earlier, when a multi-ethnic or sectarian society rips itself apart. This is what often produces the most extreme violence, not necessarily conventional warfare, though that plays a vital part in the early 1940s, but often also this horrible process that we sometimes call ethnic cleansing. Entire minorities are driven out of their traditional place of inhabitation, or actually wiped out.
That leads us to some of the myths about violence in the 20th century. When we raised this topic around the office, everyone assumed the reason that it was the most violent century was because the 20th century had the most advanced weapons. You say what?
Well, this is the most popular response. I mean, every time I talk about this, no matter where the lecture hall or the show, this is what people say. And the problem is that it doesn't work because, of course, as the 20th century went on, military technology became exponentially more lethal, particularly after you have the atomic bomb and then the hydrogen bomb. And yet, in fact, there's a tailing off of extreme violence in the later half of the 20th century. What's more, when you look at some of the worst violence of the second half of the 20th century in places like, say, Cambodia or Rwanda, it's carried out with the most primitive weaponry. Machetes, axes, sometimes simply clubs.
And what about the thinking that violence in the 20th century came because there were such evil men that launched it? You know, Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin. What do you think about that theory that evil came through one person?
Every society has its madmen, its psychopaths. It takes particular conditions for a particular madman to suddenly acquire power. And that's really why I wanted to write the book, because I don't think one can just attribute it all to three really bad guys.
As Neil Ferguson said, it's not the bad guys, it's why did millions follow them? Historian Neil Ferguson, his new book is The War of the World, a 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West, hundreds of pages detailing what he calls the bloodiest century in history. Neil Ferguson, he says he supported the war in Iraq, now says he regrets that, so when we come back, we want to ask, why is Iraq different from other U.S. occupations? And is the U.S. now an empire in decline? Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Neil Ferguson. His new book, The War of the World, makes the case that the 20th century was history's bloodiest. We've just been looking back at history. Let's look forward now. Neil Ferguson, you supported the U.S.-led war in Iraq, and I'm going to quote you. You said you argued that if it was to be done, it should be done well or not at all, but you didn't oppose it, and with the benefit of hindsight, you now regret that. Today, you say Iraq shows the U.S. empire in decline. And the other factors that came together to cause the violence in the 20th century are now at play in the Middle East. You say it starts with the failed economies there. Explain that.
The degree of volatility of growth in the Middle East in the last 20 years is roughly the same as we experienced in the developed economies in the Great Depression. There's ethnic disintegration going on at a terrifying rate. You read every day about sectarian violence escalating in Iraq, particularly in Baghdad. As Sunnis and Shiites reenact the Balkan Wars, if you like, right, in a new context. And this is a deeply disturbing possibility because, of course, it could escalate beyond the borders of Iraq. I mean, the entire Middle East potentially could have a sectarian war within Islam in the years to come if the situation isn't brought under control. And, of course, the thing that we might once have relied on to bring the Middle East under control, namely the power of the United States, is manifestly waning. In many ways, I think most informed commentators would agree that Iraq has exposed the limits of American military power. So we have, if you don't mind the term used in this context, an empire in decline right before our very eyes.
Well, some people do mind the phrase, you know, empire in decline. Explain what you mean by that. I mean, it's a fuzzier image of an empire. That it's not as clear as Ottoman, if you will, if you're talking about the U.S. as an empire in decline.
Well, in my last book, Colossus, I tried to make the case that, from a historian's point of view, any state that sends armies into Mesopotamia and Afghanistan on a mission to implant its own style of political institutions is behaving precisely as empires in the past behaved.
Even if they say they're doing it not to occupy, but to withdraw.
Yeah, the trouble is that that's exactly what the British said when they went into Baghdad in 1917. We come not as conquerors, but as liberators. That was the precise terms of a proclamation issued in 1917. So English-speaking empires always say that they're not really in the business of empire, that they're doing something much more high-minded. The trouble is that's not how it looks to everybody else. And I think the interesting thing about this debate on American empire is that it is a debate only in the United States. In the rest of the world, it's more or less a given that the United States is an imperial power. And when Hugo Chavez says something like that at the United Nations, only Americans are shocked. Everybody else says, well, you know, tell us something new, tell us something interesting. So there's a sense in which if you understand the United States as a peculiar kind of empire, an empire in denial, doesn't really want to admit that it's an empire, it's nevertheless a helpful way of understanding the world we're in, because I think compared with the power the US had in the Middle East, say in the early 1970s, it's clearly much less powerful now to determine policy in states as diverse as Israel and Saudi Arabia, to say nothing of a country that it's actually occupied, Iraq. So although my argument goes against the grain with most American listeners, I know that from bitter experience, there is a need, to quote the Scottish poet Robert Burns, to see yourselves as others see you. And I think if you recognise that, to put it slightly crudely, you're the redcoats now, an awful lot becomes clear.
And Neil Ferguson, it sounds as if you're saying that the question isn't even whether or not the U.S. should stay or go in Iraq. You're saying that the power has waned and they don't even have the choice. The U.S. forces can't affect the change that's needed in Iraq.
One of the indicators of that is just demographic birth rates, particularly declining birth rates in Europe and very high birth rates in Asia and the Middle East, mean that the West is really a much less important percentage of humanity than it was 100 years ago. In about 20 years, North America and Europe combined will account for barely 14% of the world's population. That's an awful lot less than 100 years ago. And I think you can illustrate this point in Iraq really well. 1920, the British are able to suppress an insurgency in Iraq. And at that time, the ratio of Iraqis to British occupying forces was about 20 to 1. Today, it's 210 to 1. And that's to say there are more than 200 Iraqis for every American soldier and indeed British soldier combined in Iraq. Mm. That's an order of magnitude more Iraqis. And therefore, there was never really much chance that an occupying force as small as 145,000, 150,000 men would be able to maintain order in a country like Iraq. It was wildly optimistic to think it could be done with so few boots on the ground. And I think in that sense, the book has an important implication for the early 21st century. As American structures of international order become weak, we probably should expect international violence to increase. Now, that, of course, is not an argument you will ever hear on the left. The view on the left is always that when empires go, everything gets better. My point in The War of the World is to show that that isn't so, and that very often the end of empire is a time which sees increased violence and usually a diminution of individual freedom.
And I want to rush to point out that many on the left in the U.S. think if we broke it, we need to fix it. You're saying it may not be fixable.
There's really a sense which you can see when you look at the casualty figures that the violence no longer directly concerns the invaders. It's now Iraqi on Iraqi violence, and we're not doing a very good job of stopping that because the body count seems to be higher practically every month. So this is a deeply disturbing phenomenon, and I think it's of a piece with the history that I'm telling, in which the really destructive forces that tear mankind apart aren't clashes between civilizations, but clashes within civilizations. And most people who've died since the end of the Cold War have died in wars between ethnic groups inside a particular civilization, whether it's in the Middle East or in Central Africa. So the prediction that we were going to enter a time of clashing civilizations, Islam against the West, has so far turned out to be wrong. So we need to understand why the more complex structures within civilizations can malfunction, why neighbors, and this is a really important point, can suddenly kill one another on the ground of some, in many ways, superficial religious or cultural or ethnic difference. And I think the War of the World is an attempt to answer that question. What makes a neighborhood implode? Because I think we're seeing it in Baghdad, and we saw it many, many times throughout the 20th century, all over the world, from one end of Eurasia to the other.
Neil Ferguson, he's professor of history at Harvard, a research fellow at Oxford College. His new book is The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. Neil, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. In a campaign that's already had its share of controversy, there are new allegations today that U.S. Senator George Allen used racial slurs when he was in college. There are now three reports that at least three former students from Allen's alma mater, the University of Virginia, are claiming that Allen used the N-word. He's denied those charges, and his campaign has released statements from other classmates who back him up. But this is the latest in a series of odd controversies swirling around Allen during the campaign. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick. Hello, David.
Good to talk to you.
And we should mention that Allen is running against Democratic challenger Jim Webb, a former Secretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration, but that's almost been overshadowed by these new allegations. Let's take a look at the most recent one. I guess the first charge that Allen used, the N-word when he was in college, came from a Dr. Ken Shelton, who's a radiologist now from North Carolina. What is he saying?
Well, Dr. Shelton was a football teammate of Senator Allen when they were both students at the University of Virginia. And Dr. Shelton says Senator Allen, then a student, used the N-word, the notorious racial epithet, often, and on other instances did racist things, like once on a hunting trip, Dr. Shelton says Senator Allen sought out the home of an African-American and stuck the head of a dead deer in his mailbox, in that person's mailbox. Now, he's just one person, and it would have been just his word against the senator. Now, another gentleman has come forward who is an anthropologist, a professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama. In the early 1980s, when this gentleman was a graduate student at UVA and Senator Allen was a practicing lawyer, he says that he visited the Allen property to pick up a puppy he was buying and heard Allen use the same derogatory language.
His wife at the time said that the visit happened, but that her husband, George Allen, never would have used that word. Why is Ken Shelton coming forward now? George Allen's been in public life for a long time.
Well, he says that he heard about this macaca episode where Senator Allen addressed Democratic campaign operative, a young man of Indian American descent, as macaca, and said, "Welcome to America."
In fact, we have a clip of that. This is when the young man was videotaping George Allen. He'd been, following him at these public events and taking pictures of George Allen, and it apparently got to him at one point, and he made this comment. Let's listen.
My friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas, and it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, macaca, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere.
And, of course, macaca is a type of monkey. Many African Americans say it's a racial slur. Give us some more context.
Well, it goes back years. George Allen has been dogged for a while about insinuations that date back to his affection for the old Confederacy. In his high school yearbook, he wore a pin with the Confederate flag on it at various times in his life. He's displayed a Confederate flag when he was governor of Virginia. He declared a Confederate History Month. He also opposed a Martin Luther King holiday. All of this is added up to kind of insinuations and not much more. So fast forward to this year, and then there's this episode on the campaign trail where he says, is it nonsense? Who knows what it is? Macaca word to this person of Indian American descent and says, "Welcome to America." So people say, aha, this adds fuel to the fire in terms of allegations that his racial attitudes are a little out of whack. Then the next thing that happens is a reporter says to him, is it true that your mother is Jewish? And he seems to get all defensive. It turns out that after that question, he says he learned from his mother that, in fact, she had grown up in a Jewish family. But even then, when he's acknowledging it, he seems a little bit awkward. He doesn't really know how to talk about it. And some Republicans start to say, well, that's odd. Senator Allen is a practicing Presbyterian, and he seemed not to know how to talk about his Jewish roots. At one point, he kind of made a joke of it and said, oh, I still eat ham sandwiches, you know, a reference to the Jewish dietary laws.
Well, is there any way of telling this has just blown up in the last couple of days? Is there any way of telling how it has affected George Allen's chances at reelection?
Consensus among sympathetic Republicans is this is not good. It's not good for him in his Senate campaign, and it's certainly not good in terms of his aspirations to be the Republican presidential nominee in 2008. Right now, Senator Allen appears to be his own worst enemy. If he hadn't made that macaca comment, whatever it meant, we might be in a different place right now.
David Kirkpatrick was with the New York Times speaking to us about the U.S. Senate race in Virginia and the latest charges against Republican incumbent George Allen. David, thanks so much. It's not a dull moment in that race.
No. It's certainly keeping things very interesting.
David, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, staying with politics and on a lighter note, what if lawmakers wore the logos of their biggest contributors, you know, the way NASCAR drivers wear the logos of their sponsors? Think Will Ferrell as Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
Dear Lord, baby Jesus, we thank you so much for this bountiful harvest of Domino's, KFC, and the always delicious Taco Bell.
The idea of transferring corporate sponsorship to politics appears in the premier issue of Good Magazine. The article is called Political NASCAR, and Morgan Clendaniel, associate editor of Good Magazine, joins us now with more. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, Robin. How's it going?
I'm good. I have the magazine open to the article where you have line drawings of two senators, Hillary Clinton and Rick Santorum. And in these line drawings, they're just covered with logos. By the way, we have the pictures at our website, here-now.org. So, first of all, where'd this idea come from?
We thought it was really important in our guide to the midterm elections that we shine a light on the part of politics that you don't normally see, which is the money that these senators are getting, and these visuals really bring it home.
I'll say they are covered with logos. On Clinton's side, there's MetLife, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Corning. Oh, it looks like Viacom bought her leg.
Yep.
And I should say, for Rick Santorum, his legs belong to Bear Stearns, Reed Smith, Comcast. Why did you pick these two?
Well, they are the two incumbent senators who have raised the most money in each of their parties.
And where'd you get the numbers from?
We got these numbers from the Center for Responsive Politics. They have a great website called opensecrets.org, which basically goes through the really complex filings and puts them in searchable layman's terms.
Did you come up with any surprises as you plastered them with these logos? Again, another leg of Mrs. Clinton belongs to GE. Were there any surprises as you looked at the numbers?
The biggest surprise to me is how normal it looks. These are the people who are giving them their money and who one would imagine are influencing their decisions.
It's a striking image to see them just plastered with these logos. But do you ever think that politicians will be this transparent about the money they receive?
Oh, no, of course not. But it would be very helpful if you didn't need a website like Open Secrets. It would be great if it was obvious to everyone. And so if a senator, say, proposed a bill that would give tax breaks to, let's say, Boeing, and you could easily find out that Boeing's given them hundreds of thousands of dollars, it would make politics a lot more sensible of a place, I think.
Oh, but who wants that?
Who does? Not them, that's for sure.
Morgan Clendaniel, associate editor of Good Magazine. The article we've been talking about is the Political NASCAR. It envisions politicians wearing the logos of their corporate donors. Morgan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And still to come, a new film documents the feud between John Lennon and the Nixon administration over the war in Vietnam. You're listening to Here and Now. An Iraqi photographer for the Associated Press is still being held indefinitely by the U.S. military. 35-year-old Bilal Hussein is one of 13,000 detainees held without charge by the U.S. in Iraq. The U.S. military says Hussein was arrested in the company of two alleged insurgents, along with bomb-making materials. Well, joining us on the line from New York is Kathleen Carroll, editor for the Associated Press. And I want to ask you first a question your critics have been asking. You had apparently known that Bilal Hussein was taken into custody over 5 months ago, and yet didn't report that as news, when others, such as Michelle Malkin, conservative columnist and blogger, were saying it is news when the AP's photographer in Baghdad is detained. Why didn't you report it when it first happened?
Well, we have worked very closely with the military over time when one of our folks gets picked up, usually in an operation in the field. And usually we are able to win their release within hours or days, occasionally weeks, when they are picked up in a remote part of Iraq. And usually all it involves is us reassuring the military that this is a person who works for the AP and is a legitimate journalist, and they double-check the credentials, and things move along pretty swiftly. So the first day that we were asked about it, the very day that he was picked up, we were endeavoring to find out ourselves what had happened. We kept working with the military, trying to understand why he was being held and trying to resolve his case. We have believed that it's safer for our employees to work with the military to try and resolve these issues, and when it became apparent that we couldn't do it that way, we decided to go public.
I mentioned Michelle Malkin, the columnist and blogger, and she claims to have been critical of his work long before he was picked up, saying that she saw in his photographs in particular that he had an allegiance with the insurgents in Iraq. How do you know that he didn't? What systems do you have in place to know that he had no such allegiance?
Well, first, let me address a few things Ms. Malkin has said, bless her heart. She's asserted a number of pictures as being Bilal Hussein's that were not, so she doesn't quite have her facts straight on some of those issues, I fear. We've attempted to correct her with limited success. Now, to the larger question of how do we know, you know, we hire people to cover stories, and we have a very rigorous process for vetting who they are and for working with them when they submit their material. One of the allegations is that Bilal is too close to insurgents and that he was so close he was somehow getting advance word. And our review of all 420 photographs that moved under his byline and that we transmitted to the world during the time that he worked for us found hugely dominated by pictures and images of things long after an attack has taken place.
Why do you think there was so much criticism of him even before he was picked up by the U.S. military?
War is a difficult thing. That's a gross understatement, but it really is. And in all the conflicts that the AP has covered, there have been controversial images from warfare. Bilal was covering his hometown, Fallujah, and later when that became too dangerous, he moved up the road a bit to Ramadi, both insurgent strongholds, both places that the U.S. military has had a very difficult time holding on to. And we've covered it both with the work of Iraqi journalists in Fallujah and Ramadi and with journalists embedded with U.S. forces trying to hold that area. And, you know, pictures of people involved in combat on either side are hard to look at. And he had some pictures of insurgents with guns on the streets, one or two images of them firing in the course of a battle. And I think there are people who believe that AP's coverage ought to be about which side should be winning the war, and that somehow we shouldn't be covering both sides, that to cover another side glorifies an enemy. We believe to cover a story completely, you have to be in all the places where that story is unfolding. And that's all that's going on here.
Kathleen Carroll, editor with the Associated Press News Agency. Do you expect Bilal Hussein to be released soon or tried soon? Do you expect any movement in the case?
I have no way of knowing that. We certainly hope that it is resolved in some way, that he is either charged and allowed to answer for the allegations or released. But that is obviously not in my control.
Kathleen, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. The music and politics of John Lennon ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Here and Now music critic Tim Riley has been giving some thought lately to the pop star as social activist. Tim says that contrary to what many of you under 30-somethings may think, Bono did not invent the model. Three decades ago, one-time Beatle John Lennon was writing songs like Give Peace a Chance and Power to the People. The music and the man were adopted by the anti-Vietnam War movement in a way that turned Lennon's life upside down. A new documentary, The U.S. Versus John Lennon, details those years and the Nixon administration's quarrel, almost obsession, with the musician's potential political clout. Tim Riley says the film conveys the political tensions of the era without stooping to sentimentality.
Among the more tragic aspects of John Lennon's assassination back in December of 1980 is the way his mythic status obscures some finer points of his career. Everybody knows the famous Beatle made solo records, became a house husband, and retired from music for the 5 years before the release of his last album, Double Fantasy. But not many people remember how politically active he was for the 8 years preceding that sabbatical. Filmmaker David Leaf, who's best known for Smile, his profile of Brian Wilson, puts a microscope on Lennon's political activity in the late 60s and early 70s. Leaf's new film, The U.S. Versus John Lennon, draw some unsettling analogies to George Bush's war on terror. Leaf insists these analogies are subtextual.
What we're doing is we're telling the story of John Lennon through the prism of his art and his and Yoko's campaign for peace, and there are undeniable parallels in terms of how power reacts to a threat. And that is really the key issue is what do presidents do in times of war?
For starters, Lennon didn't just wake up one day and turn political. Like most of his huge audience, he was radicalized by the Vietnam War. As early as 1965, he denounced the war at press conferences. Leaf's documentary shows how Lennon's political awareness grew from a respect for what his audience was thinking and feeling. In the fall of 1968, his song Revolution, the B-side of Hey Jude, caught the frenzy of a horrific year, which began with the Tet Offensive, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, the student riots in Paris, and the Soviet Union's march on Prague. Things heated up that summer as the anti-war protesters clashed with police outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. In the movie, Ron Kovich, the Vietnam vet from Born on the 4th of July, talks about watching the scene on television.
I was with several paralyzed veterans in a room at the Bronx Veterans Hospital on the paraplegic ward. And I remember we were watching the convention.
Mr. Chairman, most delegates to this convention do not know that thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago.
Perhaps John Lennon saw the clubs coming down on top of the heads of the peaceful demonstrators. And perhaps John Lennon had tears streaming down his face that night, as I did too.
John Lennon is remembered as a peacenik, but revolution actually disappointed the radical left. As early as 1968, they argued that nonviolence was inadequate to strong-arm police tactics. But the song's passionate ambivalence conveys what many peace-loving people felt.
When you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
You've got to free your mind instead, Lennon concluded. Even a radical black power intellectual like Angela Davis agrees with the song's nonviolence. I asked director David Leaf about the distinction Davis makes in the movie.
What Angela Davis says about revolution is in the film is that clearly the idea of revolution does not necessarily involve violence. So what she's doing is acknowledging that John Lennon was not wrong to, if he was advocating revolution, that it needed to happen in a peaceful way.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono began to toy with the media by extending their nonviolent resolve. In 1969, they held Bed-Ins for Peace in Amsterdam and Montreal and went on to mount a huge War Is Over campaign. In the movie, Yoko remembers Lennon's ambition.
With War Is Over, if you want it, I said, okay, let's do posters. And then John said, no, let's do billboards as well in all different cities in the world. Wow. He was like that because his arena of communication was much larger than mine. So he thought of that.
So people said, how much is it? I don't know, but it's cheaper than somebody's life.
That 1970 song is so stirring, it's still on playlists every holiday. Too bad Lennon's music was as powerful as President Richard Nixon's Paranoia. By the time John and Yoko moved to New York in 1971, they began hanging out with anti-war leaders Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. By then, Nixon was entrenched in Vietnam and began bombing Cambodia. The radicals wanted Lennon to headline a music tour ending in Miami near the 1972 Republican National Convention. Nixon so feared Lennon's influence with young voters, he wanted him deported. Astutely, Lennon kept filing extensions and stayed in the U.S. with his wife. He feared returning to Britain might get him banned from America forever. Leaf shows us streets full of protesters and reminds us that for all Nixon's fear-mongering, the rock audience swelled with hope. The movie delivers a keen sense of cultural payback. George McGovern, clobbered by Nixon's landslide, remembers Lennon by humming one of his popular anti-war hymns.
That's the one that went, all we are saying is give peace a chance. They'd repeat that over and over again. I thought it was wonderful. Give peace a chance. Who can be opposed to that? The administration was.
There's only one major complaint I have about the U.S. versus John Lennon, and that's that there's just too much Geraldo Rivera reminiscing. But there's always too much Geraldo. Lennon's humor and vast musical embrace far outweigh Rivera's cant. The movie places the former Beatle alongside Charlie Chaplin, Paul Robeson, entertainment activists of previous eras who faced many of the same hypocrisies. With Nixon's resignation in 1974, the immigration suit against John Lennon soon collapsed, which took on a cosmic resonance. On October 9, 1975, the day John Lennon turned 35, he was presented with his green card, officially welcoming him as an honored guest of the country. On that same day, his second son, Sean, was born to Yoko Ono after 8 years of miscarriages. Persistence had won John Lennon a new home in New York City and a family to enjoy it with, until his death in 1980.
Imagine all the people living for today.
Imagine. Here now, music critic Tim Riley is also the author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary. The U.S. versus John Lennon opens in selected cities on Friday.
Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Living. You may say I'm a dreamer.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.